Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241, November, maybe like the 22nd. Let me check my watch here in just a second. Yeah, it's the 22nd. All right, so don't forget, we have our next lecture test. And I think it's December 1st. Yeah, next test is on December 1st. That's the Thursday after Thanksgiving. All right, so then everybody will have two tests on a Tuesday and two tests on a Thursday, so that kind of evens out impact in the lab for you just a little bit. All right, last time we talked about cardiac output, so let's write an equation on the board for cardiac output. What the heck is cardiac output? What's it equal to? Cardiac output is equal to HR times stroke volume. Ah, that was a nice quiz that you guys had to take in the lab, right? So you should tell me, what are the units of cardiac output? Units of, yeah, so it's a volume per time, right? Probably minute is a good time unit right there. And heart rate is what? Beats per minute, right? And stroke volume is the amount of blood that's pumped out of a ventricle every time it beats. Not necessarily equal to ventricular volume, because ejection fraction will determine how much blood is pumped out. But stroke volume is a volume, so it is what? Milliliters, ml per beat, right? Then these beats cancel out. All right, so cardiac output is a volume per time. And what's a good way of thinking of volume per time as a physical entity? It's cardiac output really is the same thing as flow, the volume of blood flowing someplace, right? So cardiac output is the same thing as blood flow. Okay, so that's pretty important. So now let's kind of relate this to blood pressure a little bit. All right, so we're going to work with some equations here, but don't forget that equation. All right, and let's get this into slideshow mode. And then I want to, we can start there, but I want to do pointer option, so arrow options, visible. Ah, now I'm happy. Okay, so blood pressure. Why is blood pressure important in your body? What's blood pressure going to determine? Blood pressure is going to determine which way blood flows, right? So blood flow, how is blood going to flow through a blood vessel? How does diffusion work? From high concentration to low concentration, when the concentration gradient goes away, disappears, what happens to diffusion? It goes to zero. It stops, right? So blood pressure works the same way. Blood will flow from high pressure to low pressure. When there's no pressure difference between two parts of your cardiovascular system, then there won't be any blood flow. And so which way does blood flow through your cardiovascular system? Okay, high to low, but in terms of particular blood vessels, does it flow from a capillary to an artery, or an artery to a vein, or vein to an artery? How does it flow? It flows from an artery, right, through a capillary into a vein. So pressure, and we looked at some graphs last time, so pressure is high in arteries and pressure is low in veins. And what has the lowest pressure in your body? Okay, so a lot of people just automatically think capillaries, because that's important for exchange. But if capillaries had the lowest pressure, all blood would flow into capillaries from veins and arteries, and then they get bigger and bigger, explode, and be a big mess, right? So that doesn't happen. The lowest, oh, thanks for the sign-in sheet that's going around. So pressure, or blood, is going to flow from high pressure, which is in large arteries, into the lowest pressure vessels, and those are the large veins. And as a matter of fact, even the right atrium has the lowest pressure, so blood flows into the right atrium. Okay, so don't forget about that pattern. Okay, arterioles, which are small arteries that lead to capillaries, all right, play an important role in distributing and controlling blood pressure. All right, because when they vasoconstrict, right, that actually helps pressure build up in blood vessels that are proximal to these particular arterioles. Right? And arterioles then control blood flow into capillaries. And that is controlled by the diameter of arterioles. Capillary blood pressure is decreased because they're downstream from high resistance arterial. So when we looked at those pressure curves, we could see that indeed capillaries had lower pressure than arterioles, but not zero. So why is it that capillaries don't have, what's a good reason why capillaries don't have zero pressure? Because if they did, what would happen? Even blood from veins would flow into capillaries, right? So we don't want that to happen. Let's see, I want to do this. I want to get that picture on both slides. Okay. All right, so here we have kind of a fancy glass tube, right? And as we increase the height of blood in this particular vertical section of a tube, what's really happening right here? We're increasing the pressure, right? So the pressure is equal to the height of the fluid in these particular tubes. So if we maintain the height in this particular tube right at this level, then it's going to have a constant pressure. And, right, so then it's going to, and here is very low pressure, so blood is going to flow from high pressure to low out this little opening right here. All right, and if we put a constriction in an arteriole, then blood pressure is going to increase in these first two tubes, right? But since we're restricting flow through this area right here, what happens to pressure that is distal to this constriction? It's going to decrease because blood can't flow through this constriction according to Poiseuille's equation. All right, so pressure is controlled in your body by vasoconstriction in various arterioles. And I guess an important thing to remember is you don't have enough blood to flow everywhere in your body at one time. You have to pick where the blood goes, or your autonomic system picks where it goes. So for instance, when you're exercising, where is most of your blood going? Through muscles, right? And your heart, because it's pumping. And of course, your brain, blood flow to the brain pretty much is maintained because you always need a functioning brain, whether you're conscious or not, because the autonomic nervous system has to be controlling various functions in your body. All right, but when you're in a fed state, where should a lot of blood be going? To your, digestive tract, right? And not to your muscles, right? So that's why your mom always said, like, right after lunch, you wanted to go swimming. But what would she say? No way, because everybody kind of knows that you don't have enough blood to go everywhere in the body. And if you start exercising right after lunch, you could get muscle cramps or whatever because there's not enough blood to maintain the health of those muscles. Right, especially, for instance, if you're swimming. Okay, so here is a diagram of blood pressure, okay, versus various, I thought we saw this already. Well, we saw we saw pressure before. Not quite in some fancier graph. So this just shows blood pressure versus various blood vessels in your body, starting with the aorta. Okay, ending up at the vena cava, and this really shows that the blood pressure in the vena cava is the lowest in your body, so blood will flow from all of these different blood vessels into the vena cava, returning it to the heart. Okay, this top graph right here just shows the cross-sectional area of these various vessels, like the aorta. The cross-sectional area is kind of small, so this is not the volume, but this is just the cross-sectional area of these different vessels all added up together. And how many aortas do you have? You just have one, right? So this is just the cross-sectional area of the aorta is not very big, but you have millions of capillaries. And even though they're microscopic, if we add up the cross-sectional area of all those capillaries, we can see that that's the maximum in your cardiovascular system, all right? And as a result of that, right, that means that the velocity of blood in capillaries is the slowest because it has the highest cross-sectional area. And why is that a good thing, that the velocity of blood in all these capillaries is slow compared to any other place in your cardiovascular system? Yeah, because that blood has to have time to exchange, right, nutrients and gases within these capillaries right here. All right, but because the velocity is slow because the cross-sectional area is high, it still does not mean that the pressure is zero, right? So here, this pressure is not zero. Where is pressure zero? In the vena cava. So blood will flow back to the vena cava. All right, so what are some important things that are controlling blood pressure? It's controlled by heart rate, right? It's just directly related to heart rate. So if heart rate increases, what happens to blood pressure? It increases, right? And stroke volume is a measure of the contractility of the heart, the force of contraction, and it's directly related right? Stroke volume is directly related to blood pressure. So if stroke volume goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up as well. And then this third term right here is peripheral resistance. All right, peripheral resistance, again, is directly related to blood pressure. So peripheral resistance, that means if vessels vasoconstrict, what happens to blood pressure? Let's go back to that previous slide over here. Actually, it's kind of intuitive. So if we make a constriction right here, right, we're increasing resistance, what happens to blood pressure in these vessels right here? It increases. All right, so that's one intuitive way to think about it, but I'm going to give you another way right now. So if peripheral resistance increases everywhere in your body, then the pressure that is proximal to that resistance increases as well, if you look at that previous slide. All right, but I want you to become really familiar with this. All right, so blood pressure. What's another equation that can be used to talk about blood pressure and blood flow and resistance all in the same equation? Yeah, like Poiseuille's law. But let's go to a simpler one to where we don't have to consider all the factors that affect resistance, like the diameter of a blood vessel and viscosity of blood and all that kind of stuff. All right, but another important equation that you should just be familiar with is blood flow. What's the units of blood flow again? Well, we have it over here. Milliliters per minute. Okay, that's cardiac outflow, cardiac output. So blood flow. So how is blood going to flow? Two important parameters. One is going to be directly related. One's going to be inversely related to it. So blood flow, just like diffusion, there's a gradient, a concentration gradient. But for blood flow, it's going to be a pressure gradient, right? So we're going to put blood pressure right here. Blood flow is going to be equal to blood pressure. That's the driving force. And what's going to inhibit blood flow? Resistance to that flow through a particular vessel. So we're going to put that in the denominator. All right, so we're going to put resistance right here. There are other kinds of terms that we use kind of interchangeably for resistance. Sometimes we call it peripheral resistance. Sometimes we call it total peripheral resistance, but they're all just resistance, right? So how about if we just put total, your blood pressure is going to be equal to the blood pressure divided by total peripheral resistance. That's just resistance. All right? Okay, so that you should just memorize. Right? Just blood pressure over resistance is going to determine blood flow through a particular tube. And resistance is what? Determined by the diameter of the blood vessel and viscosity and those kinds of things. That's the whole Poiseuille's equation, which we don't need to get into right now. All right, now why is this intuitive, this statement right here, heart rate, stroke volume, and peripheral resistance? Well, we got blood flow, and what do we got over here? Cardiac output, that's blood flow. So actually, heart rate times stroke volume is equal to what? Blood pressure divided by total peripheral resistance, right? We can just combine these equations right here because we got blood flow and blood flow right here. So cardiac output, okay, is equal to blood flow. And let's just copy these equations down. So what's blood flow? Blood flow is equal to blood pressure divided by total peripheral resistance. And what's cardiac output? Heart rate times what? Stroke volume. All right, so here's a really nice equation, but what are we really interested in solving for? What's the topic that we're talking about in this particular section? Is blood pressure, right? So, it would have been nicer if I had it the other way around. But how can we get this TPR out of the denominator so that everything is in terms of blood pressure? Yeah, multiply both sides by TPR, all right? So we've got total peripheral resistance times heart rate times stroke volume is equal to BP times total peripheral resistance. All right, but what happens over here then? They cancel out. So we have total peripheral resistance times heart rate times stroke volume is equal to what? Blood pressure. So if stroke volume goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up because it's just directly related. If heart rate goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It just goes up. If something vasoconstricts so that peripheral resistance goes up, if total peripheral resistance goes up, what happens to blood pressure? it goes up as well. So this is a pretty handy equation just to kind of memorize, but if you can derive that equation, that would even be better, right? Because we got cardiac output is equal to blood flow, okay? So the slide is not intuitive, but if you think of it in these terms, it should become a little bit more intuitive for you. Yeah?
Will there be a mathematical problem like this for our exam or no?
But there'll be a lot of questions on the exam. For instance, if resistance goes up, what happens to blood pressure? Okay, so you probably should have that somewhere as an image in your mind so that you can answer those questions, right? And have like an intuitive sense. It's easy to have an intuitive sense for heart rate. If heart rate goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. Okay, stroke volume, if the heart contractility goes up, blood pressure should go up, which is not so intuitive as this term right here. But if you start with those two equations, I think you'll become more familiar with it. Okay. So an increase in any of these can result in an increase in blood pressure. Why is that? Because they're all directly related to blood pressure. Okay. Sympathoadrenal activity raises blood pressure via arterial vasoconstriction. All right. And if something vasoconstricts, what parameter is really changing in this equation right here? If vasoconstriction happens, what happens? Peripheral resistance goes up. And if peripheral resistance goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up as well. Okay, and by increased cardiac output, because the sympathetic nervous system goes to the ventricular myocardium, increases both the heart rate and stroke volume. Okay, so sympathetic tone drastically can increase blood pressure because it increases peripheral resistance, heart rate, and stroke volume. And if all those numbers get big, what happens to blood pressure? It gets big too, right? It just has to go along for the ride. All right, kidneys play an important role in adjusting blood pressure by regulating blood volume. All right, and as blood volume increases, you have more venous return to the heart. And as you have more venous return to the heart, what happens to the size of the ventricles? More blood goes back to the heart. What happens to the size of ventricles at the end of diastole? End diastolic volume increases, so they stretch out more. What happens to contractility of the heart when the ventricles stretch out in the normal heart? Okay, that's called the Frank-Starling law. So as end diastolic volume gets bigger, the heart gets stronger. Right? That's just an intrinsic property of the heart. If the heart beats stronger, right, stroke volume goes up, what happens to blood pressure then? It goes up as well. All right, so this can kind of be kind of a confusing maze, I think, unless you have some kind of intuitive sense on those equations. We'll help you. And don't forget, math is just a language. It's just kind of a universal language. Shouldn't be too intimidating for you. Okay, what's the most important long-term mechanism for regulating blood pressure in your body? You had to study a little bit. Okay, we talked about it last time. The most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure in your body over the long term, not the short term, not when you stand up, but day after day, week after week, month after month. Since it's long term, it's not going to rely on the nervous system because that's a fast system. It's going to rely on what? More the endocrine system in your body, right? Endocrine system is for long-term regulation, right? So that's a hint. What's the most important long-term mechanism for regulating blood pressure in your body? Is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, right? And we went over that last time. That would be a really good diagram if you could draw that out, right? So remember, we got angiotensinogen. How active is angiotensinogen? Not active, because the O-gen at the end of the word means it's inactive, right? It's got to be converted into angiotensin 1, then it's converted to angiotensin 2, and angiotensin 2 causes release of aldosterone. Aldosterone works on the kidneys to retain water and salt, right? So if your blood volume goes up, your heart gets stronger, so stroke volume increases, that increases blood pressure in the long term. Okay, but that's not going to help you when you get out of bed in the morning or when you stand up from sitting down after a long lecture. Your blood pressure is going to drop just because of change in body position, right? And you might actually pass out. So endocrine mechanisms won't help. You need a short-term regulation. So here is the most important short-term regulation of blood pressure in your body, and this is the baroreceptor reflex. All right, so you got to have this on the tip of your tongue now for the rest of your life. I'm sorry. OK? Okay, don't forget this one either, like the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone. All right, so there are some things in your body that have to be able to measure blood pressure in order to make a nice response loop. And these are the baroreceptors. There's stretch receptors in the aorta and the carotid sinuses. Can anybody point to their carotid sinus very gently, because I don't want to trigger a baroreceptor reflex in you. Okay, it's right at the convergence of the internal carotid and external carotid at the common carotid that's in your neck right there. Okay, so those are very important stretch receptors that monitor blood pressure. Increases in blood pressure causes the walls of these regions to stretch, increasing the frequency of action potentials to the cardioregulatory center and vasomotor center in the medulla. So when that artery stretches, the carotid sinus stretches, then your autonomic nervous system thinks that your blood pressure is going way up. So if you press with your fingertip really hard on the carotid sinus right here, it's going to make your body feel like your blood pressure is going way up. Like if you squeeze on a balloon, the pressure goes way up. If you squeeze that carotid sinus right there, your blood pressure in that area is going to go way up and send signals to the brain, and then your brain is going to think your blood pressure is skyrocketing. What's it going to do? It's going to say, yikes, I don't want to blow up any blood vessels. We better decrease stroke volume. We better decrease heart rate. Okay? And when that happens, your blood pressure everywhere in your body is going to plummet, and you might lose consciousness. So that's why I didn't want you to, like, press really hard in that area. Right? Because I don't want to do, like, a sleeper hold on you guys at a distance. All right? But, for instance, if somebody's doing surgery in somebody's neck, they got to be careful of that. They don't want to overstimulate the baroreceptors, because then the patient's blood pressure is going to bottom out, the heart might stop, and things would get way too exciting if that were to happen. Okay, so baroreceptors send action potentials to the vasomotor center and the cardioregulatory center in the medulla, right? And it's most sensitive to decreases and sudden changes, right? So it's that kind of receptor. All right, so here we have, and I think you look at this figure maybe the very first day in lab. So here we have stretch receptors in the carotid sinus. You know, we don't even have a picture of that in an anatomy book. That's too bad. Here's a good picture. Here's the carotid sinus. Stretch receptors in the aorta. Aorta does stretch because it has a lot of elastic tissue in it. All right? These send signals. So this would be, what, the afferent pathway into the cardioregulatory center. What does this cardioregulatory center have? Let's just think of it in terms of a response loop. So we got receptors, we got afferent pathway. Here is, what do we call this center right here? In terms of a general response loop, this is the integration center. What does an integration center have? So that it knows something about these signals that are coming in from your body. It has a set point. It has what normal blood pressure should be, so it compares the input signal to what the set point should be. So the integration center makes a decision on what to do. In this particular case, if blood pressure decreases, what would be a good decision for the cardioregulatory system to make? To increase blood pressure by, okay, sending signals out through the sympathetic nervous system, okay, and these will increase force of contraction of the atria, force of contraction of the ventricles. What's that going to do to blood pressure with this equation right here? Right? It's going to excite the heart, so the stroke volume is going to increase, that's going to increase blood pressure. But sympathetic nerves, right, also go to the sinoatrial node, and it's going to increase the slope of the generator potentials from those nodal fibers. That's going to increase heart rate. Okay, what's going to happen to blood pressure? Just from that aspect, it's going to go up again, right, which is going to be opposite from what I said the initial stimulus was a decrease in blood pressure. So this is a nice negative feedback loop maintaining pressure in your body. And what's not shown on this slide, but it is shown on the slide that I prepared for you for lab, is that sympathetic nerve fibers actually go to arterioles, right, cause vasoconstriction. What happens to resistance when a vessel vasoconstricts? The resistance goes way up, okay, so when we have an increase in sympathetic tone, stroke volume goes up, heart rate goes up, and resistance goes up. And what does that do? That maintains blood pressure. That increases blood pressure. So that's a nice baroreceptor reflex. All right, if the blood pressure were too high, then the cardioregulatory center will send out signals via the parasympathetic nerve to decrease heart rate. And that's the only option for parasympathetic innervation. Parasympathetics don't go to the walls of arterioles, typically, and parasympathetics don't go to the ventricular myocardium, so it can't adjust blood pressure through those two mechanisms. Only by what? Chronotropy, adjusting the chronotropy of the heart, not inotropy or peripheral resistance. So here is the figure that you have in your book. We kind of talked about this already, but going from a line to standing position, right, when that happens, blood will pool in your extremities, right, when you stand up, and when it pools in your extremities, it's not being returned to the heart, so there's decreased venous return. And then end-diastolic volume is decreased because you have less blood going back to the ventricles. And because of the Frank-Starling law, if end-diastolic volume goes down, the heart muscle gets weaker as a result. So stroke volume goes down, cardiac output goes down, right? And then blood pressure is going to decrease. That is the stimulus by standing up, a decrease in blood pressure. And how is it that you don't pass out? Because you have baroreceptors in the carotid sinus, right, and aorta. They're going to send that signal to the medulla. That's the cardioregulatory and vasomotor center in the medulla. And the decision then is made by the medulla because it compares it with the set point. That's going to increase sympathetic tone, decrease parasympathetic tone. Increasing sympathetic tone will vasoconstrict arterioles. That will increase resistance. What's going to happen to blood pressure? If you increase resistance, it's going to go up, which we see right here. Okay, sympathetics will increase the heart rate, which is going to increase heart cardiac output, but also don't forget about increasing stroke volume. Increasing sympathetic tone will increase stroke volume, so there could be another arrow going down pointing to cardiac output. That will increase cardiac output. All of those things will increase blood pressure. How does that relate to the initial stimulus? Will it add to it or subtract? It will subtract from it, so what kind of loop is that? It's a nice negative feedback loop, and that maintains homeostasis in the body. All right, so I had to put, because this is a long slide, I had to put baroreceptor reflex over here, kind of on a vertical instead of horizontal, so don't forget baroreceptor reflex. Okay, what is the importance of the baroreceptor reflex? Control of blood pressure over the short term, like change in body position. All right, so not the long term. What's the most important mechanism over the long term? The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Okay. All right, you guys kind of look like you have headlights in your eyes a little bit here, so I don't want to say what the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism really is. It's really, what is the title that I like to use, but I really don't want to scare people. It's the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. But look at it, and you don't have to fear it, okay? It's not too bad. All right, so that's it for this particular chapter. And that's it for the next test, okay? That's it. All right, so that's, what, a week and a half away, okay? Plenty of time to study, especially since you have a vacation in between, yeah. The one on Thursday. The last, I don't know anything about the last one just yet. Okay. I think I have to look at that to tell you what's going to be on that test. Okay. So probably at least two chapters, probably respiratory and urinary system. But keep coming to class. Okay. Okay. But first, I know, it's sad. So few classes left. Okay, so we got, yeah. Okay, let me find, oh, that's right, this button doesn't work. Let me find the next one. Which is, I know, it's really sad, it's the end of the semester, but it's not all bad because Christmas is coming.
I don't know if that's a good thing or
it's still sad. Okay, don't be sad over Christmas. Because I'm sure you still have to take some chemistry classes or something.
I'm all done with my chemistry.
You're all done with your chemistry? That is cool. I don't know if that's ever true. I said that probably about 20 times for math.
No,
all right, this is my last math class. And guess what? I had to take more. And then I said, all right, this is my last math class. And then I had to take more.
I do have microbiology.
And then I got to where I liked math classes.
You still have to do microbiology, though.
Micro. That's, oh, there you go. So you still have to take micro. Okay. Respiratory chapter. I think it's still chapter 16. All right, so respiration encompasses three related functions. Ventilation, which is just moving air in and out of your lungs. And I lost the cursor. What happened to it? Did I turn it off completely? What did I do? Here it is. No, it's visible. Should always be there. All right, so respiration encompasses three related functions. Ventilation. All right, so ventilation is just moving air in and out of your lungs. That's ventilation. We'll look at that. Gas exchange. All right, a gas exchange between air in your lungs and gas in your blood, and also gas that's in your blood and gas that's around your tissues. All right, like, and then oxygen utilization. That's cellular respiration. But we already spent a whole chapter on cellular respiration. What's the whole point of cellular respiration? To utilize oxygen or to make CO2, produce lactic acid, is to make what? ATP. That's the whole point of cellular respiration, right? And oxygen, of course, is important for that. So we're not going to go over that again. All right, so ventilation moves air in and out of lungs. Gas exchange, sometimes we call this external respiration. And then cellular respiration, sometimes we call that internal respiration. Not very many times, but sometimes, right? So there's a little bit of difference between internal, actually a huge difference between external and internal respiration. All right, and gas exchange is passive, which means it happens by diffusion. So which way do gases move? From high concentration to low concentration, right? All right, so don't forget that our cells need oxygen to make ATP via mitochondria oxidative phosphorylation. So where is oxygen concentration lower? In the mitochondria, or is it lower in the atmosphere? Okay. Well, since you have to have high oxygen in a mitochondria, it's reasonable to think, well, it should be a high concentration in mitochondria. But guess what? If it wasn't higher in the atmosphere, then oxygen would leave the mitochondria to go into the atmosphere. Right? So you have to change your thinking just a little bit about this. Where oxygen is high is in the air that we're breathing in the atmosphere, and it's low inside your cells, and so therefore oxygen can diffuse into your cells. Okay? So I know I got confused on that point too. And what about CO2? Right? CO2 is leaving your body. So where is CO2 at a high concentration? Inside your body or in the air? Inside your body, right? But it leaves because it's almost close to zero in the atmosphere. So there's a huge concentration gradient. So CO2 leaves. So let's look at some respiratory structures. You're kind of familiar with this from anatomy already, right? You got the lower respiratory tract starts at the larynx. And when you have an inflammation of the larynx, what do we call that? Laryngitis. Why is that? Because what's in your larynx? Vocal cords, right? And when those get inflamed, they don't vibrate back and forth, and so you lose your voice. So there's a difference between a laryngitis and a pharyngitis. So that's part of the conducting zone. And then from the larynx, you have the trachea that you see right here. And then here's the carina, which is the bifurcation between the primary or main left bronchus, and here is a primary right bronchus. All right, these structures, these airways are held open by cartilage, because in order to get air moving in and out of your lungs, there has to be pressure changes, right? Because air is a fluid, it's going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. So in order for air to leave your lungs, what should be the pressure inside your thoracic cavity? Should it be a higher or lower than atmospheric pressure if it wants to leave? It's got to be higher, right? And when you have a balloon filled with air, how do you make the pressure inside a balloon higher? You squeeze it, right? So in order to make pressure in your lungs high, you have to squeeze down your thoracic cavity. And when you do, these passageways right here might get squeezed too and collapse. And if they collapse, what happens to airflow? It won't move, right? So when you're trying to exhale because of high pressures in the lungs, if these tubes were to collapse, remember, resistance increases as what? The fourth power of the radius, so even small changes in diameter or radius of these tubes right here would drastically reduce airflow. Right, so these things can't collapse. They're held open by cartilages, the laryngeal cartilages and the tracheal cartilages and the bronchial cartilages right here, so that they don't collapse or even get a little bit smaller. Okay, so all of this is part of the lower respiratory tract. And then we have more and more bifurcations, right? So you go from a primary bronchus to a secondary to a tertiary, smaller and smaller and smaller, until finally you get to some microscopic structures. Right, and these are what we call bronchioles. And bronchioles is the first place in the bronchial tree right here that do not contain cartilage. I don't see any cartilage right here, but they do have smooth muscle on them that are controlled by the sympathetic nervous system. Oh, what kind of receptors are on those smooth muscles? Are they cholinergic or adrenergic receptors? Adrenergic receptors, and of which variety? Okay, which variety? Well, you got alphas or betas. Betas are good, guess. And then you have subtypes of betas. Beta 1 or beta 2? Beta 2. Okay, beta 2. And those are inhibitory to smooth muscle. So sympathetic stimulation of these bronchioles right here will cause bronchiolar dilation. What happens to flow of air when these bronchioles dilate? It goes up in a big way, right? So don't forget, in the fight or flight response, you have sympathetic increase in sympathetic tone. It's going to cause bronchiolar dilation, which helps you breathe. It enhances, right, ventilation. Okay, the other thing about the respiratory zone right here, which starts with bronchioles, is that there can be some alveoli on them. All right, so here we have a terminal bronchiole, and these alveoli are sites for exchange. So this is where CO2 can leave the body and go into the air inside of an alveolus, and oxygen that's in an alveolus go into a capillary, right? So it doesn't have to be an alveolar sac, but even these respiratory bronchioles have alveoli on them. So gas exchange happens in an alveolus, right? Not necessarily just in any old kind of bronchiole, but these special respiratory bronchioles. And we have about 300 million alveoli in our body, so quite a lot of them, right? And that's the site for exchange to take place. I think we talked about this already. All right, so here is an alveolus. Let me look at the next slide. All right, I guess I'm going to talk about it right now. So here is an alveolus, and here I see a capillary right next to it. So this is a very short distance that gases have to transit to go from the air and alveolus to get into the blood, or from the blood into an alveolus. And it's a thin space, because what can you tell me about this epithelium that makes an alveolus and then makes the lining of a capillary? It's a nice simple squamous epithelium, which is the thinnest kind. That's the kind of epithelium you need for exchange, right? So the shape of an alveolus right here is such that it allows the maximum area or surface area for exchange with this capillary. All right, now when you think of a surface area for exchange, what should you really be thinking of? Just in everyday language. I don't know if I've done it in this class, so let's do a little demonstration. Here I have a ruler, maybe from anatomy you could remember this. Here's a yardstick. Did I do this demonstration for you in here already? I think not, okay. So here is a nice yardstick, and if I want to measure the surface area of this piece of paper right here, how would I do that? I'd measure the width, and I'd measure the height, and then I'd multiply the two numbers together to get the surface area of this. So this is 8.5 inches by 11 inches. That would tell me the surface area of this piece of paper right here. Okay, that's how you calculate surface area. We could calculate the surface area of this table right here, or we could calculate the surface area of this door right over here. So let's do that with this ruler. Let's see if I can multiply these numbers in my head. So what's, don't forget, surface area is the width times the height. What's the width of this door right here? Yeah, I see, that's before you need this password. What's the width of this door right here? 1 meter. Okay, you can come in. 1 meter. In order to calculate surface area, we need another number. What's another number do we need? The height. So what's the height of this doorway right here? Here's 1 meter, okay? And then we've got, what do we got for the height? Oh, exactly what? 2 meters. So what's the surface area of this doorway? It's 1 times 2, or 2 square meters. All right, so that's for that doorway right there. How many people can get through that doorway at one time? Maybe 2, 3, okay? Get a head running start, maybe 4 at maximum. So instead of a doorway like that, consider the doorway to your garage that the car drives through. What's the surface area of that doorway? Bigger or smaller?
Bigger.
Lot bigger. What about number of people going through that doorway at the same time? Oh, yeah, you could maybe get, if you really tried, maybe 100, okay? Well, for sure, 20, maybe 50. All right, so as the size of the doorway increases, what can you tell me about moving people through a doorway? It's directly related to the surface area of that doorway, right? So think of moving people in and out through a doorway from the classroom to the hall as exchange, right? That's just exchange of people from the classroom to the hallway. So in terms of exchange, as the doorway gets bigger, what happens to exchange? It goes way up. Okay. So let's now consider the doorway or the surface area of all of these alveoli right here. All right, so we said there's about 300 million of them. Let's take one alveolus, peel it like a grape, because it's a sphere. Peel it like a grape so we can make it flat. Then take the next one, make it flat, right? Just peel it, make it flat, put it on the table over here, and do that to all 300 million. How big of a table would we need to put all of those alveoli on? And that would be about 70 square meters. All right, so that's a huge surface area for exchange. So exchange can happen very rapidly. So again, when you say surface area, what's the everyday word I want you to think of? What did we measure over here? Doorway. So when we say surface area for exchange, think of doorway. And the lungs, if we were to do that with all the alveoli, it would be about 70 square meters. But what does that mean? Have you ever been on a tennis court? That's half of a tennis court. So the surface area for exchange is as wide as a tennis court, but it would only be like half as tall. But still, I'd find that really inconvenient. I see no reason why I want to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall, right? So the body has kind of folded that surface area up, and we can do that with this thing right here, right? We can take this 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, which is a surface area, and do what to make it fit in a smaller space? Yeah, just fold it up. And I know this isn't like really precise folding, but it's still folded up. All right, so now we got something really, really small, but it still has the same surface area. Okay, so that's the purpose of an alveolus. So what Hans's exchange is the simple squamous epithelium, and there is something called the respiratory membrane, which I'm going to talk about in just a second after I describe the alveolus right here. So here is a cell, right, that makes the epithelium of an alveolus. There are other cells that we have in here. This is what we call an alveolar type 1. Here's an alveolar type 2 cell. And it's kind of glued to the to this alveolus, and it secretes a product. And it secretes something called surfactant. And surfactant is like a detergent that flows over the inside surface of this alveolus, and it does something to water. But I want you to consider what kind of molecule water is. Is water a slippery molecule or a sticky molecule? Is it more like oil or is it more like glue? And you're right, it's a sticky molecule, right? And that's because of what? Hydrogen bonds that form between water molecules. And even some animals can walk right on the surface of water because they're not heavy enough to push the water molecules aside. Anybody ever see that? Yeah, like insects. Right? Water spiders, things like that, can actually walk right on the surface of water because of the property called surface tension. All right, so I just want to demonstrate, make sure that you all see surface tension. Here I have a couple transparencies from some class, all right? And if I put them together like this, and I hold it vertical, and I only hold on to one of them, what's going to happen to the other one? It falls off because these are dry, okay? So here we have a couple, I didn't say that, I have a couple dry acetates, transparencies. If I put them together and let go of one, the other is just going to fall right off. All right, but what can we use that we have in this room for glue? We could just use some water. Now, do you think that's really going to work? Probably. I don't know whose notes are in here, but now they're going to be what? They're going to... I'll show you what's going to happen. They're going to do what? They're going to stick together in there. Don't tell them that I actually did that. Okay, so now I just got water in there, and I got these two acetates put together. All right, I'm going to hold them both up. I'm going to let go of one of them, and what happened? They got stuck together. Okay, so maybe on Thursday when you do dishes or something, like a couple saucers, and they're wet in between them, if you just pick one up, guess what? They're all going to get stuck together, right? You got to slide them apart. So, as a matter of fact, we could try sliding these apart. I don't want to drip on your computer. Oh, the outlet's okay. It's your computer. So grab the bottom one, and just see how difficult that is. Oh, look, I'm lifting you up out of your chair. All right. So surface tension is a huge problem because the inside of this alveolus right here has water in it. Right, these walls are going to get stuck together. But what do you got to get in there to live? It should inflate. There should be air going in there. So this alveolar type 2 cell secretes a compound called surfactant, which destroys surface tension. It's really, really slippery so that these alveoli can't inflate. All right, so that's the job of this type 2 cell. And there's also some macrophages in there. Macrophages are monocytes. They're shapeshifters, so these can crawl out of the cardiovascular system, can crawl out of the blood, and crawl around in an alveolus. And this is kind of a white blood cell. And what's the job of a white blood cell? To fight infection, right? And we're breathing in viruses and bacteria and fungi all the time. So the macrophage clears that up for us. All right, so know something about surface area, the type 1, type 2 cells, and this macrophage right here. Okay, so now I can get back to something called the respiratory membrane, something that allows for exchange between air and blood, and it is the wall of the capillary. That's one part of the respiratory membrane. The second part is this very thin interstitial space, which just has some loose connective tissue in it. And then we have the wall of the alveolus. That's the third part. And then the fourth part, I don't see on this slide, but I don't want you to think about it, and your book maybe doesn't mention it as part of the respiratory membrane, but there's a thin layer of what? Lining the alveolus on the inside. Surfactant, right? So that is the fourth component of the respiratory membrane. Wall of the capillary, small interstitial space or thin interstitial space, wall of the alveolus, and then a thin layer of surfactant, which allows this alveolus to expand. Okay, between these alveoli, so here's a neighboring alveolus right here. There are pores that allow for air to go from one alveolus to the other, right? So that just helps in the distribution of air in these different spaces. All right, the conducting zone, I don't think we're too concerned about, other than maybe you should know that what's the epithelium in this conducting zone right here? It's not a simple squamous epithelium because it's not for exchange. Oh, I left the lights on. Sorry about that. I can turn some of these lights off. That one I'll leave on. Maybe this one I'll turn off. Anybody remember from anatomy what's the epithelium that lines all of these? Okay, well, I see cartilage right here, but remember an epithelium, it covers the surface or lines the cavity, and here's a tube. So it's lining. It's the lining of this trachea right here. It's lining of the bronchi. So what do we got? Simple squamous, we got stratified squamous, transitional we find in the bladder because they're shaped because a bladder gets big and small all day long. Yes, okay, it's coming back to you. It's called pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. Yeah, I know you know that. Because those cilia, I don't think I have a picture of it, unfortunately, but those cilia are important for motility, right? They're just extensions of the cell membrane, and there's microtubules in them. So they actually sweep. Which way are they? And also, in that kind of epithelium, there are goblet cells. What's the function of a goblet cell? Secrete mucus onto the apical surface right here, so that mucus is kind of like sticky stuff. Dust particles and bacteria get trapped into the mucus, and then the cilia are sweeping. So it's sweeping all that mucus and nasty things that we breathe in. Which way? Up or down? Okay, yeah, you don't want down because that's just a dead-end space. It would fill your lungs up with infected mucus, right? So these cilia are sweeping up. It moves that mucus up into your oral cavity. And then what do you do? No, I'm sorry. Okay. To be expectorated. Well, expectorated means spitting, and if you're a baseball player, that's really good. But if you're a student in my class, I would expect you not to expectorate in class. Okay? And indeed, no one, I didn't have to report anybody to the dean for that. Right? So you swallow it down and get it out of your lungs. Okay? All right. Thoracic cavity. You should know where the thoracic cavity is. The lower margin is the diaphragm, right? And then the rest of it is just formed by your thoracic cage. Contains the heart, right? And other things in the mediastinum. The heart's in the mediastinum. The thymus is in the mediastinum. Right below the diaphragm is the abdominal pelvic cavity. Not really necessarily related to the respiratory system, except in one case that we're going to talk about. Okay, so mostly we're going to be concerned with the thoracic cavity. So here is the thoracic cavity, and here are the lungs, right here and over here. We can see the bronchial tree going, and just posterior to the trachea, you see the esophagus, and here's the heart. And the thoracic cavity on the outside, what's the name of the cavity that the lungs are in? It's a subdivision of the thoracic cavity. Yeah, it's the pleural cavity. And the pleural cavity on the outside, is that open to the outside world or not?
No.
It's not. So what kind of cavity is that? We call that a serous cavity. So it has a serous membrane over it, right? And can anybody remember how many different divisions are there to a serous membrane? Yeah, there are three. The visceral serous membrane, or the visceral pleura, is right on the surface of the lungs. And then on the wall of the thoracic cavity, we call that the parietal division of that pleural cavity. And in between, like in this space right here, you can see the space continuing around, that's filled with serous fluid. Okay? So those are the three parts. So the intrapleural space is filled with that thin fluid layer between the visceral pleura, right, and the parietal pleura, right in there. Now this fluid is watery, okay, and it does not have surfactant. So what does that serous fluid do? It prevents friction. These things can slide, the two membranes can slide back and forth, but what are they really? They're glued together, right? So when the when the pleural space expands, it pulls on the lungs and it expands the lungs. Right, so the lungs are attached by serous fluid to the wall of the thorax. Okay, unlike the spaces inside the lungs have surfactant, which allows them to unstick so that they can expand, for instance. All right, what else do I want to say about this figure right here? You got pleural cavity. I think that's probably pretty good. All right, some physical aspects of ventilation. All right, so air is a fluid. It's going to flow from high pressure to low pressure, right? So ventilation results from pressure changes or pressure differences induced by changes in lung volumes. Air moves from high to low pressure. The lungs are highly compliant. Oh, we did an experiment, I think, last time. What does compliance mean? If there's a small change in pressure, what happens to the volume of a vessel if it's highly compliant? Like veins. Small change in pressure means a vein can change its diameter very drastically. Okay, same thing for the lungs. Small changes in pressure mean that they can expand greatly. If pressure decreases, then they can go back down to a small volume. And what does elasticity mean? Okay, that means once the alveolus is stretched out or when lung tissue is stretched out, if you take that force away that's stretching it out, if you release that tension, then the lungs are going to go back to their original location. Okay, and then don't forget about surface tension right here. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. So all these things influence ventilation. all right, so the visceral and parietal pleura normally adhere to each other because it's just a watery substance right here. And so the lungs expand and contract along with the thoracic cavity. That's how that happens. We talked about this already, the serous fluid in the intrapleural space, right? So here's the intrapleural space, it's between the lungs and the thoracic wall. That's a sticky fluid that allows for movement, but yet these things are still attached to each other. All right, so during inspiration, intrapulmonary pressure, right? That's the pressure inside the lungs, inside like the airways and the alveoli, is about minus 3 millimeters of mercury. And all of these pressures that we're talking about right here are above or below atmospheric pressure. So that's a little disclaimer that we have down here, right? So atmospheric pressure is about 760 millimeters of mercury. So you would subtract 3 millimeters of mercury from that if you wanted to find out what the absolute pressure was. But we're just going to say atmospheric pressure is zero, right, to make these numbers a little bit more convenient. So during inspiration, what about pressure inside your lungs? Is it above or below atmospheric pressure? It's 3 millimeters below. That's what the minus sign means, which means what? Air is going to flow from the atmosphere into your lungs because the pressure is lower inside your lungs. During expiration, then, okay, you have higher pressure inside your lungs compared to atmospheric pressure. So again, that air is going to flow from high to low, high inside your lungs to low in the air around you. Okay? All right, the transmural pressure, that's the pressure between the interpulmonary space and the interpleural space, right? We're going to look at that. It always keeps the lungs inflated. So transmural pressure, right? Let's look at the table down over here. Intrapulmonary pressure on inspiration is minus 3, on expiration it's plus 3. The intrapleural pressure, that's the space between the thoracic wall and the lungs. On inspiration, it's minus 6, and on expiration, it's minus 3. So it's always going to be negative, right? That keeps the lungs adhered to the thoracic wall. But the pulmonary pressure right here is always going to be a positive, whether it's inspiration or expiration. So because the transpulmonary pressure is always positive compared to atmospheric pressure, that means that the lungs always stay inflated to some degree. There's higher pressure inside the lungs compared to atmospheric pressure, which is a really good thing. Because if this intrapleural space, right, is connected to the outside atmosphere, like through a chest puncture or something, then this transpulmonary pressure gets to be the same as atmospheric pressure, and the lungs totally collapse as a result of that. And hopefully it's just one lung and not the other, because the spaces are separated from each other. What do we call that when somebody has a perforation to the intrapleural space? We call that a pneumothorax when that happens. So they can move their respiratory muscles, but air is just going to flow through that hole into the intrapleural space, and lungs won't inflate as a result of that. Okay. So that's probably pretty important to realize. All right, here is another little equation, Boyle's Law. It says that pressure is related to volume, but in which way? Inversely related, right? And so this volume right here, we're thinking of the volume of the thoracic cavity, right? Or the pulmonary, the pleural space. All right, so if the volume increases, if the volume of the thoracic cavity increases, what happens to pressure in that area? It decreases, right? So if it decreases, then air is going to flow into the lungs. So as the volume of the lungs, or volume of the thoracic cage increases, the pressure decreases and air is going to flow into your lungs as a result, right? So Boyle's Law implies that changes in intrapulmonary pressure occur as a result in changes in lung volume, and that is definitely true, right? Pressure of a gas is inversely proportional to the volume. One way maybe that you can think of this, sometimes you have a fireplace at home and you light a log and it's all set up, but to really get that fire started, you have to blow on it, okay? And if you blow on it for like 5 minutes, you get really lightheaded and you might pass out. So there's a little device that you can use, right? Instead of you blowing on it, there's a little device called a bellows, right, that blows air into the fire to get it started, all right? So how do you get air blowing out of a bellows? Do you make the volume big or small inside? Yeah, you push down on the bellows, and what happens to air? It comes squirting out, all right? In order for the bellows to squirt air out some more, what do you got to do? You got to put air back in. How do you get air inside the bellows? By expanding the volume, decreasing the pressure, so air flows in. And then to get air flowing out, what do? Compress it, make the volume small, that increases the pressure, so air flows out. Okay, so think of your lungs kind of acting just like that. All right, so decrease in lung volume raises the intrapulmonary pressure, causing expiration. when you decrease lung volume, just like when you decrease the volume of bellows. Okay, compliance is just a concept that describes how easily the lung expands with pressure, right? It's very compliant, so small changes in pressure cause big changes in lung volume. All right, and compliance is reduced by factors that cause resistance to that distension. Right, maybe I can tell you something about that. Elasticity. Let's look at this slide right here. Really good picture in your anatomy book that shows alveoli, and there's a capillary network around each alveolus. But what's not shown in your book, not only do you have a capillary network, you have a network of elastic fibers around each alveolus. So when an alveolus expands, it stretches those elastic proteins. Okay, and then when the volume of the thoracic cavity decreases, these elastic fibers do what to this alveolus right here? Cause it to constrict back down. And when the volume of an alveolus decreases, what happens to the air inside that alveolus? It exits your body, right? So we call that elastic recoil. Okay, so elasticity is the tendency to return to that initial size after distension. And there are important elastic proteins around every alveolus and every expandable space inside the lungs. Elastic tension increases during inspiration and then is reduced by the recoil during expiration. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the most important ways when we're breathing just quietly that expiration takes place. Expiration takes place passively due to elastic properties of the diaphragm and elastic properties of the alveolus. So we can do this experiment right here. I got a plastic bag. No, I got a balloon and a paper bag right here. Okay, which one is a better model of an alveolus? Okay, not just because of its shape or color or anything, but because of its properties, its elastic properties. So let's pretend here is a paper bag. It's an alveolus. So on inspiration, what happens to this alveolus on inspiration? It should expand. I don't see any holes in the paper bag. That's good. So, okay, so that's on inspiration. And then I'm going to open up the plastic bag, and what's going to happen to air inside this paper bag right here? It's not plastic, it's paper. Okay, the paper bag, is it going to collapse?
No.
It's just going to sit there. Okay, now what's your initial impression of that? Is that a healthy lung or not? You got air in, but what about your next breath? It's got no place to go, right? Because this alveolus is already expanded, right? So you're going to start turning purple. All right, so here is another example of an alveolus over here. All right, so I'll put some air into this alveolus. Oh, that's pretty good. All right, so it expanded. So here we have not like air in an alveolus right here. And then after we remove the tension that's causing the expansion of this alveolus right here, we're going to relax, okay? And what's going to happen? What's going to happen to all this air inside the balloon? It's going to exit, just like that. Good, I didn't smack anybody in the face. What's a better example of how an alveolus should function inside your body, like this paper bag or like that balloon over there? Like the balloon, right? So as soon as you relax muscles for inspiration, the alveolus that we see right here, okay, is going to shrink back down to its size before it's stretched out, and that's going to help expiration. So expiration under most circumstances is not an active process. It's a passive process due to the elastic properties of the lungs, okay, the bronchioles, and the alveoli, especially these alveoli, but the diaphragm as well has elastic properties. So the diaphragm goes back to its original shape. Okay, so elasticity is really important for what process? Expiration. So people that no longer have the ability to produce those elastic proteins inside their lungs, they're really hurting because they can't breathe because they can't expire. And if you can't get air out of your lungs, then there's no way to get new air in, right? They can't expand anymore. So elastic properties are really important. Don't trip on that balloon on your way out. Plus, I want to have it too for later. Okay. Surface tension is another important property. If we look at this slide right here, okay, if the surface tension was equal between a large alveolus and a small one, the small ones would collapse and push all of the air into the large alveolus, which means what? Of all the 300 million alveoli inside your lungs, right, if surface tension wasn't reduced, all of the air and all those 300 alveoli would flow into the biggest one. So you'd have like one big alveolus inside your chest instead of 300 million. And if you just had one big one, the surface area would go from 70 square meters to maybe not even 1 square meter, which means the doorway would shrink down. You would have no pulmonary function for exchange if that were to happen. All right, but as a result of surface tension, the surfactant, which destroys surface tension, then that equalizes the pressure between large alveoli and small ones so that you don't have a collapse of a lung as a result of that. So that's really the take-home point I want you to realize about surface tension. All right, so small alveoli and large alveoli can expand to the same degree because there's no surface tension on the insides of those walls right there. Okay, and we talked about the type 2 cells that produce, you can see surfactant here now lining. So I see the respiratory membrane real nice. I see a layer of surfactant, the wall of the alveolus, a small thin interstitial space, and the wall of the capillary right there. All right, surfactant isn't produced by abnormal lungs, and that's really important for premature babies, for instance. If, of course, they're born prematurely, it's these type 2 alveolar cells that develop late in fetal development. And even if it's fully developed, these cells don't produce surfactant unless the fetus is experiencing stress. So if there's a cesarean section, these cells don't get nearly as stressed as during a normal parturition, and they don't produce surfactant, the alveoli don't expand. We call that respiratory distress syndrome. So what can we do for a newborn baby that's having trouble inflating their lungs? Or what do we have to do for them? Put them in an incubator which has high oxygen concentration. All right, so that increases what? If you have high oxygen concentration in the air you're trying to breathe? Okay, not just air, but oxygen. The concentration of oxygen, so now you have a higher gradient, concentration gradient, right? So that just, that enhances exchange. All right, in adults, they can undergo that with a condition called acute respiratory distress syndrome as a result of septic shock. That decreases compliance and surfactant secretion, so then they need higher pressures in order for the lungs to expand, right? And that's a difficult condition to treat as well. Okay, mechanics of breathing, gee whiz, I guess we're going to start there next time. Okay, so this slide just shows the lungs before inspiration, and then this plain film over here shows the volume of the lungs after inspiration, and you can see that there's a big increase in volume of the thoracic cavity, all right, for inspiration. All right, we're going to talk about these slides next time, but don't trip on that balloon over there someplace, wherever it is.